Okay, welcome everybody to this discussion, this panel on participatory governance. Apparently my time is already done. No, maybe there is a mistake, I hope so. Technology sometimes doesn't help. So thank you for being here. I know that we are all rather tired. It has been a very intensive, exciting, and I would say, in a way, revolutionary week for all of us. You know, I think that we arrived here with our ideas, background, and I hope, at least this has been my experience, that in meeting all of you, in being here, teaching and listening to, I have changed some of my ideas. And you know, I think that changing is kind of crucial step in the Anthropocene. Now, we need to change. And so I believe that we are on the right track here. So I don't want to waste too much of your time. Just a few very quick words about this participatory governance topic. The Anthropocene is a call to arm. Facing global ecological crisis, humans must act. And strongly enough, in this time, we are having some kind of Leninist coming back to the basic question: what should be done? Well, according to somebody, including myself, maybe this question is a little bit not the best one. We might ask rather, instead of asking what, we might want to ask how. How should we decide what to do? And how should we do what we decide to do? In the Anthropocene, there is an overlapping, you know, with the so-called globalization and the Anthropocene, and both conditions challenge the usual ways in which we think about what is political and how to act the political in this world. And there is a huge, you know, raising of new non-elected bodies and so on. And also a very huge crisis of representative democracy, no? In the face of all this, participatory research, democracy, participatory everything seems to be the answer. So I am curious to listen to our distinguished panelists, what they think about this, because sometimes I wonder, is this participatory democracy actually what will enable us for change, or is just a way to governmentalize, you know, recalcitrant subjects, to actually include everybody in a huge governmental project. So I am going to present our panelists. First of all, Stella Vesciana, she's an artist. She's the founder of the research art platform at the Federation of German Scientists and in Berlin. And I think that she has been crucial, instrumental in putting together civil society organization and scientists and researchers in trying to implement, you know, a more democratic participatory process in research strategies and policies. Then we will have Tobias Honing, architect from the Academy of Fine Arts in Nuremberg. And finally, I would like to introduce you Christopher Brick. She has not been with us all along our campus, so we are very grateful that she is now here to help us to understand also from kind of outside respect to our own curriculum, what is his thoughts about participatory governance. Christoph works for the German Agency for International Cooperation, right? So, Stella.
So thank you very much for your introduction. I hope you hear me well. Okay. So here we are again. Now in somewhere in the orbit with a common view on the Earth's surface and maybe with a common sense of concern and desire for taking care and of shaping the Anthropocene curriculum. So first, I will talk about the processes of building perspectives at the campus, and more particularly on how these viewpoints evolved around the question of how participatory can a participatory governance be? And further on, I will present my own perspectives on this wording and my own practice. So we see here an image of the NASA that is composed with a lot of images, participatory action of a lot of people all over the world in a CASSIS project. So what is participatory governance all about? It has been a concept that has been become increasingly prominent, but it's also controversial. It has been discussed a lot, if it's beneficial or really detrimental to democracy. So let me quote a definition of the Institute of Development Studies, what participatory governance means. It focuses on deepening democratic engagement through the participation of citizens in the processes of governance with the state. The idea is that citizens should play more direct roles in public decisions, making or at least engage more deeply with political issues. So participatory governance relates to the political dimension of knowledge in the Anthropocene. As Bernd Scherer said, all knowledge has a political dimension, referring to the Anthropocene as a political statement that leads us to the necessity of new political and social action. The Anthropocene as a term is already being used by the scientific advisory public bodies, as in 2011 by the report of the German Scientific Advisory Council on Global Change, BBGU, and it refers to the Anthropocene as a fundamental political field of action, which makes a transformation toward a climate-friendly and sustainable society very urgent. So that would be the German view on it. So during the Anthropocene campus, different aspects of the relation of the Anthropocene have been discussed in the different seminars. And a specific transversal concept came up, and where I'm quoting here, that is the concept of transversal terms and conceptual migrations. I found quite interesting this terminology. And it was raised by analyzing, for instance, the meaning of governance in different contexts. In the seminar Disciplinarities, that was part of the connecting dimension, the concept of governance was raised within the case of study of climate engineering. Which technologies are discussed in climate engineering, and who is going to decide on its implementation? And how knowledge is made more visible and accountable to support science policymaking? So this last question is closely linked to the dimension of representing, and was discussed in the seminar Slow Media from the perspective of how to link head, hands, and heart in our communication practices. How do we implement the knowledge through collective experiments that address political issues linking all stakeholders? And this question, again, relates to the dimension of claiming. More specifically, there was a very intense debate in the seminar in geopolitics that has been also addressed in the agency panel now about the concept of activism and its conceptual migrations, how the term of activism has been translated and how it has evolved in different countries. And this question gave rise to other conceptual migrations, as the notion of activism related to proactivism, referring to the conceptual transfer from the political to the entrepreneurial context. So all this led to problematize the role of civil society organizations in politics. How does activism, governance, and participation relate to each other? Within this context, Ariel Weismann made a very thought-provoking, I think, comment, stressing the issue of intrinsic problematic of NGOs, activism, being constrained to a permanent restlessness due to the problematic of their funding conditions. But more importantly, he referred to the irresolvable nature of the claims, for instance, for justice, that can be defined conceptually but not be achieved on the when they become materially articulated as political claims. They hold always the contradiction of asking for the unachievable and the achievable on the same time. So how can this double nature of claiming be related to participative governance? Let me introduce you with the following proposition of rethinking shared spaces of encounter, raising the question of us and new approaches of creating a connectedness between us, and try to address the question of how we share knowledge and how we integrate it into a responsibility-driven collective action. This takes me to relate the concept of participative governance to a statics. The question that I try to address from the artistic research practice are linked to question as, how do we apply participative governance in the Anthropocene, introducing more participative practices and structures, for instance, in the scientific system, questioning what we are doing here, questioning our conference systems, our practices where we share, where we meet, where we have exchange. And also, how do we advise policy councils? How we get more introduced in the structure of policy making? So, trying to address these questions, I developed in collaboration with Dan Norton the Challenge Yasunit platform, a platform that connects specialist knowledge from a continuous series of transdisciplinary conferences. Art installations are used to bridge these conferences and present concepts that I'm sorry you cannot see, but it's like here we are trying to discuss several concepts. In this discussion platform, we also discuss different terms that are transversal and that can be selected. And in this process of linking and mixing, there is a new way of trying to connect transversal terms. And one of the main elements of this Challenge Yasunit project is a growing archive of video interviews that are presented using an interactive software. So keywords are transversally used to present each interview sequence that can be accessed directly with this Dropbox menu. And so similar themes and reference from specialists can be compared and contrasted. And the knowledge gets locked in long narratives, can be easily identified, selected, and mixed. What we are trying to do here also. So this artistic approach allows viewers to rapidly synthesize alternative propositions by mixing expert opinion. And this mix offers a manner to bring the inevitably defended expert opinion into play within an undefended space. So, what does it mean for the Anthropocene curriculum? In which way does participative governance matter at all? So I think that participative governance within the Anthropocene implies a radical openness fostered by transdisciplinary, intercultural, and sustainability-oriented research to explore deeper concerns related to international conflicts, to democracy and justice. Participative governance also gives the opportunity to reframe and cross-perspective processes of transformation. Participative governance can improve civic skills and social well-being, but there are, of course, questions related to the impact and to the effectiveness that have to be questioned and that should be addressed by the Anthropocene. And I think also participative governance raises the fundamental question of a hybrid profile, how Roger Malina calls it. And I think that concluding, the Anthropocene campus has contributed significantly in stimulating this hybridization, bringing together passionate scientists with analytical artists that, in my opinion, lead to transform our self-perceptions. And here I just want to mention the proposal that was raised during the campus to conceive ourselves as indigenous, getting beyond the excluding use of terminologies and to focus more on our common concerns about the earth by finding new ways of how we want to live together by shaping a participative governance in terms of a public interest that is beneficial for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry if it's not such a nice job to do the moderator because you have to stop people that are saying very interesting things. Thank you so much for being also on time, and please, it's now Tobias.
Okay, I had the pleasure the last 2 days to be part of the seminar Anthropogenic Landscape, and as we just finished last afternoon, I'm still like thinking in all the things that we have been talking about and that arise from that seminar. So it was kind of difficult to do the switch and maybe to talk about an outcome and in relation to that term that we are discussing right now. So I more or less decided to step back as far as I can to introduce you into what we actually did or the case study that we selected for our seminar. And then in the end to ask you a question that I think somehow it was discussed very intense at the end of the seminar, and I think this question was somehow driven by, or from the background driven by, the question for participatory governance in a way. So what we see here is a picture of the Berlin district of Lichtenberg before the industrialization. And that was the place that we went to on Thursday. You see here a picture from the time of the GDR, so we are in East Berlin, a city district which is characterized by leftovers of the 19th century's buildings, but also by the huge housing that was done by the GDR. And the site we focused on is an industrial area which was once occupied by an enterprise called VEB Elektrokohle Lichtenberg, which actually means this was a people-owned enterprise there. Part of the workers there in this enterprise was a huge amount of people that came from North Vietnam to East Berlin to work there, but also, of course, a large part of the people working there were Germans. So, as most of these people-owned enterprises in the GDR were handled over to the Treuhand, which was a state-owned company that was founded to privatize the state-owned companies in the GDR after the reunification. Also, this enterprise was part of the Treuhand and not sold for a very long time. There was always the hope that somehow this factory could be kept, the graphite production there. And in 1994, it had to be closed. And what followed was the dismantling of this factory site, of course. So you can see some steps how it was done. And this is 2014 now. So more or less, these two huge concrete towers are the symbol for the site in a way, but they are not occupied by any activity in a way, because the main activity on this former site is done at a place which we can see here in the forefront of the two towers, which is called the Dongshuan Center. And the Dongshuan Center is a place that we maybe falsely referred in the seminar always to be run by the Vietnamese community. That's already a point where we could probably arise the question of participation in a way. So you see our group here, the seminar group, we went to this site, and the main task for everyone in the group was to somehow get into this place to find a gaze, a way in this place with the background from the specific scientific background that they came from, but also like in a personal thing. So the site was observed. We went to the restaurants there, of course. Took walks to the market halls that are on the site, run by the Vietnamese people. But also the scale switched, so very, very focused scale. Leftovers of culture. And then the participants started to somehow work with some of the artifacts that were found there. Try to arrange them, try to do something new with them. We tried to switch the scale, so we went up on these towers to have a different perspective on the site. And then we ended up in the conference room yesterday, and everyone kind of gave an idea what they discovered on site, what they observed, and I have really to say it was really amazing because we formed six groups, which was also a very interesting process of participation in a way, and could fill our own seminar. But the main point was at the first half of the day, every one of us was kind of happy with the outcome, even where we all were aware of the fact that we could only scratch on the surface of this particular situation. But then at a very certain point, we got into a huge discussion, and that was the point where we, where at least someone in the group asked for action. Action in this case in the form of design, where some architects, as I'm an architect, were involved in the group. And then of course it was, the discussion was about the point, how can we intervene in this place after just being there for one afternoon? Can we even intervene after 30 days, 60 days? What time do we need to know that place? And to give you a short idea why I think that participatory governance is probably a driving force behind this, is that I think that a lot of the people wanted to take agency for the Vietnamese community there at some point, where we don't know a thing about, and I don't think it's a very participatory organized community in a way. The interesting endpoint last night, to come to the end, was that we found out that this community that we, some of us wanted to take agency for, already decided to design themselves and feature like huge projects on development on their website in a way. So I just wanted to put this as a case study now also for our discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Tobias, and now it's Christoph, right?
Yeah,
you have your microphone, right?
Yeah, I have my own microphone, I think, yes. I come from a, I think, different background in a way, because I haven't been here at the campus for the last couple of days, and this is my first encounter with the subject, actually, and I've been asked to reflect on, you know, what does participatory governance mean for from my background. I work at the German Agency for International Cooperation, GIZ. We're a government-owned enterprise, and we implement development projects in developing and emerging countries. And for us, the term is very important, and I'm actually quite happy that the term made it into this forum, because I was told that there was a big discussion whether it should actually be a separate term or not, or whether it actually falls together with agency or is just fine to talk about agency. And when I was in the agency group just before this session, somebody asked to what's the end. Well, I would be interested to understand, how do I become an agent, actually? Like, what gives me agency? And I thought this was a very nice question, leading over into participatory governance, because in my mind it immediately popped up, well, through a governance process that is participatory, that gives you voice, you actually have the chance to become an agent, meaning an agent, somebody who has some power of influence, some way of making him or herself heard. For the work that we are doing, it is very important, because we we believe that change processes for more sustainable development cannot be prescribed or cannot be decided by only one institution, like be it now a government or be it a big multilateral organization, but it actually requires the working together of different actors. One example of this is, for example, you have this product here, lemonade, that you that is available here. It's a very fair trade product, and so I want to use this example maybe to make my point, which is that in producing this product is a rather complex process. This one here is made out of, I think, organic oranges. And so the question is, if we think about a complex system that we are working or that we are living in, and we assume that it is getting more and more complex all the time, and with complexity, I mean, I don't know what they are talking over there in the other forum, I mean that you cannot say what effect your action will have within a system, but that it can go in various ways, and not the individual is not able to actually predict his or her actions. So the question you could ask is, if I buy a bottle of lemonade, does this, or what kind of effect does this actually have on the orange farmer in Brazil? Because maybe you are concerned about the well-being of smallholders in poor regions of Brazil or anywhere else in the world. GIZ is, so that's why I take this example. And to have some idea or some process of making this connection in a complex supply chain is, for example, the development of a standard, of a sustainability standard. Lemonade uses the fair trade process, which is a standard that was developed by the Fair Trade Labeling Organization. And the development of a standard is a very participatory governance process, because you try to bring all the perspectives of stakeholders, so these people who are in some way affected by this, into the development of a behavioral norm. And why do they do that? Because they know that it needs a certain degree of ownership, a certain degree of acceptance of the individual behavioral norms that are prescribed in the standard, which if they are not existent, then the standard is effectively not working. And I think it's an interesting term also, because it's, I think, one of the few terms here that has two words in it. And namely participatory governance. And when we distinguish governance from government, it is clear that we are talking here about something that is more of a process than of a strict condensed body that makes decisions. But the adjective participatory also gives a normative element to this. And this means that we have a maximum, or at least in my understanding, a maximum participation in a certain governance process. And I think this is a useful way of limiting governance or further describing governance, for the reason that the more people who are involved in a decision-making process, the more stable the decision may be. And in the end, a more stable decision will then lead to a situation where we have less conflict over what has been decided. But it is definitely also a more cumbersome process. But to close, I think for us it's a very important term, and it's not so really a question, do we have it or do we need it? We're actually trying to, or we already are living it to a degree. And one last point, I think with regards to what does it mean for a curriculum for the Anthropocene, I think there are certain capacities that are needed for people to be able to manage participatory governance processes. And one of these capacities is to work well under situations that are unclear, that are ambiguous, and to try to navigate through such situations, because you cannot really make an either-or decision anymore if you have 20 stakeholders in the room, but you try to make decisions based on uncertainty. And for this, I think we need different skills and competencies, especially also for the people that are taking on, at some point, leadership positions in whatever organization. So I think that would be an interesting component of such a curriculum.
Thank you, Christoph. Thank you to all our three panelists. I would like to open the discussion to the floor, so I don't want to occupy the space, please.
I just wanted to ask a short question or make a comment. I was somewhat bothered by your translation of VEB, which is people-owned industry if you translate it directly, but if you translate a GDR, then it means German Democratic Republic, and I thought that the VEBs weren't as people-owned as the German Democratic Republic was democratic, so I wanted a question to clarify on this people-owned, because, I think participatory and people-owned like GDR are some different things. Or
I mean, I used the straightforward translation, as also the German terms for this are still saying this, but this is already an interesting point, because, I mean, these people who were said to own this place, they are not there anymore, but I think as this is not as obvious as it seems to be, also the different communities that are on this place as actors are not so, it's not so obvious. I mean, how is this community organized? How is there's also a Pakistani community, how is this organized? How are we organized as kind of intruders when we go there, which was of course a question where most of the people came from a scientific background. Therefore, and it's probably very difficult to go deeper on the terms of GDR and people-owned enterprise in a way.
Thank you. Over there, please.
Okay. One of the last topics that was brought up is how do we navigate a political landscape in which 20 or so shareholders are all expressing their points. And one of the things that seems to be happening now is he who shouts the loudest tends to have their viewpoint dominate or overwhelm others. They may shout louder because they care more or because they have more resources to amplify their voice, but how do we determine what's just or fair in a landscape where that is common and very common?
This is a question for everybody. It's a kind of very difficult question. Anybody wants to reply, or maybe we can collect?
I mean, the intuitive reaction to this is, this describes also the, in a sense, collective action problem. Like, in a sense, some people are even participating in a governance process, but don't have a lot of voice or power. But at the same time, you may also have people who are actually affected, but they don't have a way of organizing. So it's actually, these would be two different aspects of it. And my response to that would be, to some degree, a structure that allows for participation distributes the power within such a governance process in a fair way. But then the question is, how is that structure being decided upon?
Maybe an example for this, how this can happen, is a platform I've been working with that is called Forschungswende. That means the change of science or the turn of science. And this platform is about different civil society organizations that are quite big, but they are holders of millions of people, sort of, that collaborate together with science institutions that are mostly focused on transdisciplinarity, that is not so common in the German science system, in order to, in this platform, promote more collaboration in scientific projects, but also in the political science agency. And how do they do this? They have been doing this in a self-organized way, and they have tried to do this really like through workshops and presenting their demands. They have developed like over years, 1 year and a half, to the political institutions and negotiating. I think a very important thing is negotiating within and making transparent how this process is not defined like from the beginning, just with the demands, but it is a process that needs a structure, I also think so, for this participation to evolve. Because if you demand also participation, for instance, in science policy making, you need the people to be able to take part of it.
and you cannot just demand this participation, then the, only the loudest, as you said, will participate. But within a structure that you collaborate and negotiate all together, like what is this Forschung Wende trying to do, I think there can be found a way how this can happen. But it's not a recipe. It's something that evolves together.
Thank you. Please.
I have two comments. First is about the word participation, because it has been used very successfully in the recent times from the left, from the right, from bottom up, and from top down institutions. Just think about the word participatory democracy, and then, but also participatory budgeting. As you know, for instance, if you take participatory budgeting, this is something that the state or the governments will give to communities to fight for in the future. And I've been involved in a project in Canada when the community I worked with, who were not well articulated, couldn't get the money. So basically, if you're not articulated as a community in this, the future fight for participatory budgeting, it's a real problem. So we need, it would really be important to understand that the word is used by the left and right, top down and bottom up. So this is first thing, and the second thing is that I've been involved in the state of Acre in Brazil, which is located in Amazonia, and maybe they are like a sort of a hidden secret. They are really, the government there is really successful in sustainable development of the forest, of the rainforest. They, for instance, say, we are not regulators, we are moderators. And if you Google the policies, you can understand that it's been the government and the communities really work together. So maybe it's a question for Stella, and they are successful in sustainable development. So I always think that maybe state of Acre that has been excluded from this super market economy had a chance to rethink the practice much quicker than we do here in Berlin.
Thank you. Over there, right?
Hello, I'm Agata from the campus, from this Anthropocene curriculum. I would like to follow up on the who shouts the loudest with the question that here we all of you emphasize the need for a radical openness and focus on the common concerns. But to my experience, I think, and maybe to other people, that maybe the problem arises how to participatory govern the competing claims or the moments where we cannot arrive on this discursive compromise, or how to be radically open but retain your personal and political stand on things. So I found this movement to radical openness like a very difficult thing to do, and maybe you should elaborate on how to participate something which is competing and incommensurable, as we said in previous panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe somebody wants to, from the panel?
I think this question for the radical openness is something which arised in our case study exactly, because this site is highly polluted with, I don't know how many chemicals in the earth, and this community there is more or less the only group who is willing to work with that side any longer, which is something in on the first hand which we really like, but on the other hand, the us going there and now bringing this specific case study already in the course book or whatever it will occur, we already intervened, we already made them visible in a way, and there's also the question, do we even want that? Because they are very well organized, that's the thing where I wanted to point out, and they, I think, are not participatory at all. A lot of people work there, they work very hard, but they, I think they are not asked for the decisions that are failed for this side. So the question is a little bit, do we, when we face this problem, how do we recite then? So are we going always for the openness? How radical can we be with these decisions?
Stella?
Yes.
Regarding the question to the Amazon, I have this example of the Yasuni case, and maybe in some sort of ways it also answers your question relating to the Laos. If you think, for example, in the Yasuni case, I don't know how familiar you are with it, that is in the Amazonian, there's a national park that is protected where they find oil, and in the first time they tried to build out of a civil society initiative this demand to the international community pay 50% of the income that would not be gained by letting the oil in the soil. So this initiative failed because after 7 years, only 10% of it was raised. And Correa, the president of Ecuador, decided that he would give licenses to oil companies, and but furthermore, I think it's really despairing because you have to think that out of this great debt that Ecuador has, like I think they made a deal with China about $9 billion dollars. So what does this mean for civil society engagement? I mean, what can people in the communities do? China will really co-direct and influence directly in the big infrastructural infrastructures they're going to build there. So it's not only the Ecuadorian government now, but also China's interest. And they will not be contemplating very much the indigenous rights. And so for me, I think isn't it really something impossible you're demanding? Isn't it an impossible claim, what Weissman was saying? But we don't have to give up. We have to go on. We cannot just accept this. And this is my point, that maybe we will not be loud enough in relation to the real circumstances of in which economical terms all these struggles are dealt with. I think it's really, but I think in this process of negotiating and finding structures on and how these processes really can be developed, because in the Ecuadorian constitution there is the right of nature, and they cannot implement it anymore if they tried ever. So well, I think the international community has the duty to do something about it.
Maybe one comment also, I mean, it doesn't address it exactly, the question of that was asked, or radical openness. I'm not quite sure what framework this is referring to, but one thought that I had was, I think there's a need to define spaces for participatory governance. So, I mean, it sounds nice, it sounds great, everybody's involved, you know, we can all talk and everybody gets hurt, but I think there are certain situations when participatory processes make a lot of sense, and then there are situations when they don't make sense. And I think that for such a curriculum, it would be an interesting task, I think, also to look what defines a situation where participation and participatory governance processes make sense. From what I believe from our work, it makes sense when you have basically strategic decisions, when there's a lot of uncertainty, when there's a lot of unknown factors, and when it is about what are we going to do in the future. So when no individual person can actually know what's going to happen, but you really try to get into this multi-brain thinking, so you try to leverage each perspective of each participant, then it makes a lot of sense. If on the other hand you're in surgery and the surgeon starts a participatory process on should we, you know, remove the heart or should we remove the liver, I mean, of course, it's a crass example, but I think it makes clear you don't want a participatory process in that moment. So.
Well, you made the best example, right? But it's kind of exceptional in a way. Please.
Hello. Yeah. Thanks for that point. That's really excellent, because actually it sort of sums up something that I've been coming to sort of coming around to that opinion myself, I have to say that I've become more cynical over the last 10 days of this campus. I mean, I was cynical already, and I didn't even think it was possible, but I've become far more cynical. And I, in fact, think there's a fundamental contradiction between democracy or participatory governance and solving problems of global change. I'm really very cynical that if we, humanity, if there's a lot of debate around we, but let me use it, I don't think we are going to make the decisions, the big decisions that we know are necessary in the here and now, if you are being very participatory about it. That's the kind of, I mean, 100 people, and I find that it's impossible to reconcile opinions. So I find it extremely hard to believe this is this climate change and participatory governance, wow, go together.
Can I take advantage of my position of power for once? No, it's true, I mean, but isn't it also the case that this is what is happening? Because we are talking about, oh, we will never make it with participatory governance. You know, we need, but what is happening now is that, you know, the 1% of the world is making decisions for all of us. So it's not that we are in this mess because we have been participating too much. No, it's impossible. We are in the emergency room and we need to decide about the surgery. It's a kind of the other way around, isn't it? I mean, so far, it's not that the people have decided. I don't have any say about the Shell, you know, mining, prospecting in the Niger Delta. They didn't call me. They didn't ask my suggestion. And when somebody tried to make a suggestion, they killed him, you know. So so the Ogoni struggled there. So but of course it's my absolutely personal opinion. I completely respect the other point, and I like cynic people. So we are. And if I may make a question for the panelists, so do you think that yes, sure. Do you think that are we asking, because there was an issue about what is justice, what is fairness, no? So first of all, my first question is, do you think that we can actually, you know, people can actually ask for justice? Is justice something that you have to ask, or there is another way actually to act justice? And the second, is participation something that somebody will give, deliver to you? So you put together a process and you will allow people to participate? Or it's actually, there is another way that, you know, participation may be, this is a way, but is there also another way? So justice and participation, I am curious about what you think about it. It's something that, you know, people have to ask, somebody will deliver it, or there are other ways?
These are the easy questions for the end to close with.
Sure. I am not supposed to answer, right? So but and maybe we can collect, because I don't want to... you were asking... Please.
Yeah, so the question I had is, what gives in it's assuming I can say the word correctly, what gives a person the right to participate in governance? I would argue not just existing is enough for me to offer my opinion on something that I have no knowledge about. For instance, if I am an aeronautical engineer, I should not be able to participate in best practice for surgery. That's ridiculous. I would argue that knowledge of a specific field gives you the right to participate, or that makes it more just. Similarly, if you are apathetic, that takes away some of that right. You may give that or grant it to someone else. But if you are apathetic and don't wish to participate, you still have an opinion. You've just expressed it through someone else.
It's yours.
It's mine.
yours.
I think the question is very, very valid, but also difficult. What gives me the right to be part of a governance process? I think we have the concept of stakeholder has this concept of, I don't know the English term, Betroffenheit. So if you have if it will affect you, what will happen with that decision? You're the one who should be given a voice in advance. It doesn't matter whether you know anything about the subject or not. So I think the issue of having a stake in a certain decision would also be a criterion that should be taken into account. And then what came to my mind when I listened to you was just already, you know, different forms of bodies in a governance process, you know, advisory body, steering committee, implementation committee, and, you know, different feedback loops. And that's how you develop a standard, for example. And so you can actually differentiate the different groups and how much voice they will have at which point in the process. So from an implementation perspective, that would be my reaction to that.
We have only 4 minutes, so maybe we can have just a quick...
regards to the question of legitimation. How legitimate is that 70% of the stakeholders in the Council for Research policy making are from industry? Either they are selected in a democratic selective process? Not really. I think it's more about thinking about processes, how we can share our knowledge, even though it seems like maybe that I have no idea about certain issues. Maybe even being a specialist from a certain field also implies that I'm kind of blind, just looking with a particular way on issues, and that we particularly need really this interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary taking seriously the expert of the everyday. And how do we do this process is exactly what the transdisciplinary science is trying to find out. It's something that is emerging, that probably we're going to do a lot of errors. But I think it's worthwhile to think about, you know, all the birds that are dying now because of this wind, moon, you know,
turbines.
Because, yeah, that have not been considered why this technology was developed. There are a lot of things that cannot be seen in advance. And, okay, we have 4 minutes, so...
I would just finally say that I think we have to explore the borders of the systems we have right now and try to stretch around as much as we can on these borders, because we cannot, I think, completely erase the systems we have now. We have to learn how to cope with them in a way and how to change them in a probably first small way, and then, as strange it might sound, in a bigger way.
Very good. Thank you. So I think that we need to thank everybody for this wonderful discussion, and I hope to see you at the next Anthropocene curriculum, right, Roman? No, thank you so much. So next session, right?
There will be a lot of breakdown.
Yes. Okay, and then to the next session. Thank you.